Hi, my name is Sten Sundahl. Together with my son Per, I run a Swedish company called Sundahl & Sundahl. We have been Microsoft's close partner in architecture ever since 2004.
Hi, I'm Per. I'm happy to welcome you to the first of 5 episodes of the Software Architect of Microsoft Platform mini course. This first episode is called Business Driven Intentional Software Architecture. It's about one of the most important and also one of the most underestimated factors in software architecture, the business factor. With that said, I would like to hand over to our team member, Troy, who will guide you throughout this mini course. Enjoy.
As you can see, there are 3 concepts in place here: business-driven, intentional, and software architecture. Let me start with the third one, trying to give you a sharp and easily understandable definition. As you'll see, that's not as easy as you'd think. This one is offered by the formal standard for architecture descriptions. Take a few seconds to read it. Does it concisely tell you how to draw the line between architecture and implementation? Does it help you decide if one particular aspect of a system is part of its architecture or not? I think not. This definition is too abstract for that. In an early 2015 keynote presentation called Agile Architecture, published on YouTube, Martin Fowler and Molly Dishman tried to explain what architecture is. Their first notion was that the architecture of a software system consists of things that are hard or expensive to change. They then said that the architecture of a system is the important stuff, which they said often correlate with the things that are hard or expensive to change. So here are 2 definitions of software architecture. One offered by a formal standard about architecture descriptions, the other one offered by a high-profile expert on software development. Does any of these definitions give you a good idea about what software architecture is? How to draw the line, being able to point and say, this is part of the architecture, that is not? I guess not. It seems that as a community, we're not so sure about what software architecture is or what it should be after all. In the 1960s, Frederick Brooks managed IBM's OS 360 project. His definition of software architecture had 2 important characteristics. It was short enough to be handy and sharp enough to be operational. It helped draw the borderline between architectural and technical design. Here's his definition. It's the consumer's view of something technical. It doesn't say anything about the internal implementation of that something. Well, let's see what this means in a modern service-oriented context. Let me begin with an architectural overview of a system. Brooks talks about consumers of something technical. We can see 2 kinds of consumers here. First, there's the user. He consumes the web application. Then there's the web application. It consumes 3 information services: customers, sales, and products. The real consumer of these services are the web application developers. They have the consumer view of the 3 services, and they must understand how to use them. But they don't have to understand how they're implemented. All they have to know is the interfaces the services will expose. In this diagram, I've removed the user, putting the communication between the web application and the services in sharper focus. The services now expose service interfaces. The web application consumes the services through these interfaces, which means that the consumer doesn't have to know anything at all about the service's internal implementations. The services are now black boxes. Is this enough? Does this describe the consumer's view of the services? No, not completely. To be able to use the services, the consumer must know all the details of the interfaces involved in the conversation. For example, that there's a find customers operation. But even that isn't enough. The consumer must know how to specify which customers should be found, and it must understand what's in the response and how that response is structured. Here, the picture is clarified. It's not yet crystal clear, though. Neither the customer in list of customer nor the company name pattern parameter are yet described. They need to be, or the consumer won't know how to use the operation. So architecture is not only about the high-level, super-abstracted things that many believe. It's also about details. When you change any of these details, the consumer is affected and must modify its behavior. That's what makes this small detail architectural. For example, going from a string parameter to a complex type parameter is an architectural change. It is because it affects the consumer, who must adapt its behavior or fail. Going from customized SQL statements for data access to entity framework is a much, much larger change, but if it leaves the service interfaces, which are the service's contract with its consumers, intact, then no consumer will have to adapt to the changes. They can go on like they did before. That's why this is a technical rather than an architectural change. So if a change to something might affect consumer behavior, that something is part of the architecture. If not, then it's part of the implementation. That's an easily understandable definition of software architecture, and it's also a highly operational one. But what about the software architecture being business-driven? When a business manager invests in software, he expects business results from that investment. He expects the new or modified software to help him meet certain goals and solve certain problems. Sadly and ironically, description of these business goals and how they should be measured tend not to be included in the requirement specs for that software. This is what almost any developer or software architect would tell you, and it shouldn't come as a big surprise because they would also tell you all the other things you see on the screen right now. In short, most developers and architects would tell you that the requirements they get tend not to be fit to work from. So they work together with real users to turn these unstructured, incomplete, inconsistent requirements into a set of much better structured use cases or user stories. In both cases, a real goal is at the center, so it's okay to talk of both use cases and user stories as being goal-driven artifacts. This, for example, is the most common template for user stories. It specifies the user role having the user story, what the goal or desire that motivates it is, and what the benefit or benefits of performing it are. This is a real user story example. The sales assistant wants to register new sales opportunities so that a salesperson can pick them up and contact the prospective customer person. Role, goal, and benefit. In a use case model, the user role is referred to as the actor role. Here, the sales assistant is connected to the use case called Register Sales Opportunity. The name of the use case is an expression of the use case's goal. Opening the properties window of that use case gives me a chance to select the Requirements tab and then the Primary Actor Goal requirement. The actor's goal is specified as one action, to have the sales opportunity prepared and registered, and one benefit, to make it possible for a salesperson to contact the potential customer. You should now notice two important things. The goal you're setting now is expressly noted as an actor goal. There's a different goal called business goal. When you interview users asking them about their goals for an activity, you'll always get the user's goal, which isn't necessarily the same as the business goal. Let me now select the business goal for you. As you can see, it's more verbal than the actor's goal and the user story user goal. Quality attributes have been added, as for example, registered quickly enough without unnecessary time lag and all the information needed. There's also a reference to the sales opportunity registration latency constraint. Let's have a look at that one as well. This is really important information. The business goal for the register sales opportunity activity is now measurable. Having access to this information makes it possible for you to understand that date-time information must be included when a sales opportunity is registered and build data structures and mechanisms so business managers can monitor the achievement of this goal. This thing with measurable business goals is one part, an important part, of business-driven requirements. Without this kind of information, it's impossible to build a software solution that really helps the business reach and monitor its goals and solve its problems. Now, in most cases, you can't get this kind of information from users. Well, they just don't know. This is especially true when goals and workflows need to be changed. The new goals are seldom communicated well enough for most users to be able to give you this kind of information. You really need to go to the managers for that. And yet, both use case analysis and user story authoring are based on the idea of talking with users, at least when used the traditional ways. This is why the software that we build so often conserves the business in its old forms rather than help enhance it. Notice that I'm not saying that you shouldn't talk to users. Well, you should, and you must. They're the best possible source of detailed and operational information, but they're not as good a source of the business perspective. Which brings me to the second part of making requirements business-driven. Using a business process model to identify use cases and user stories. I'll show you how. This box represents an entire business process on its highest levels. It could be a sales process. It takes inputs, such as inquiries, and convert them to outputs, such as sales orders. Business processes are the most important parts of a business architecture. The best way to achieve software-to-business alignment is to establish a software architecture that's based on a corresponding part of the business architecture. An organization's high-level goals are distributed out over its major business processes. This is where you get the connection between business processes and business strategy. If you can base your software architecture on the major business processes, the software you build from that architecture will be strongly connected to business strategy. Every business process is decomposed into business sub-processes, which can then be recursively decomposed into lower-level business sub-processes. So every time such a decomposition takes place, the business can distribute a higher-level business goal into a set of lower-level business goals. Notice here that manage sales opportunities is one of the sub-processes. When you're decomposing a business process and when you reach a level when the user can do the thing in one sitting, then you've arrived at a leave in the process tree. You've reached a business activity. You can't, for example, manage sales opportunities in one sitting. It's an ongoing process and it should never end. In contrast, though, when you register a sales opportunity, you start doing it, and in a few minutes, you're done with it. That's one of the characteristics of a business activity. The other one is that it should generate business value available to the organization as such. It's on this level, the business activity level, that you'll find your potential use cases and your potential user story epics. I say potential because even if most business activities can benefit from IT support, all of them can't. Only those that can are potential use cases or user story epics. Now, I can guarantee you that if you use business process models to identify your use cases or user story epics, your solutions will become much better aligned to the business, its activities, and its perspective on information than they've ever been before. They'll produce better business value, and when the business must change their processes, as they always will have to when competitors and customers put pressure on them, well, then the software will be much less of an obstacle than it typically is today. There's one little problem with that. Business process models are seldom included in your typical requirements spec. Sometimes you can ask for them and get them, but more often than not, you'll have to do without them. But you can get along quite well without them, and yet reach a result that isn't far away from the ideal set of business activities a process model could have helped you achieve. Sten has written an article about that. We're not publishing it openly. It's entirely meant for those who take our Certified Software Architecture Microsoft Platform program. However, Sten is willing to let you download a copy if you wish as a thank you for being with me all the way to here in this episode. The link you're seeing on the screen right now will take you to that article. So that's what it means for a software architecture to be business-driven. What remains now is to find out what it means for it to be intentional. If you Bing on intentional architecture, you'll get a large number of result pages. The idea of what intentional architecture is or should be varies, but that's only to be expected. It's like that with all terms. Grady Booch wrote about it as early as 2006, contrasting it with accidental architecture. He said that every interesting system has an architecture. He also said that some of these architectures are intentional, but most of them appear to be accidental. He elaborated on these terms, saying that an intentional architecture is explicitly identified and then implemented, while an accidental architecture emerges from the multitude of individual design decisions that occur during development. If you draw a high-level overview of the perceived system's architecture and then begin turning requirements into user stories the traditional way, if you then take one user story at a time, giving it to the next developer that's free, then there's no way the architecture of that system will be intentional. It will be accidental. And there's no way that any non-trivial software system, the architecture of which is accidental, will be well aligned to a corresponding business architecture. It will be software-to-business misaligned. So, what am I saying here? Am I saying that a waterfall process with a big architectural effort up front is the only alternative? No, I'm not saying that. But there's no time left for me in this episode to give you an agile alternative. But I will do that in the next episode, the one called Agile Service Architecture for the Agile Business. Thank you.